Okay, we're going to discuss primary financial statements, and I give the floor to Michelle.
Just we start with agenda paper 21A on the management performance measure. The paper provides a reminder of the staff proposals at previous meetings and the board discussions so far. The board hasn't yet taken any decisions on whether to require or permit a management performance measure. However, at past meetings, the board has been generally quite supportive of the staff proposals to try and introduce it into the financial statements with suitable disclosures supporting the measure. However, the board has had mixed views on what constraints there should be on the measure and also how and where it should be presented in the financial statements. Now, the staff have provided a list of what we think are the outstanding issues in paragraph 15 of the paper. However, we think that before tackling those issues, it would be useful if we could first clarify what our objective is in allowing or requiring a management performance measure. So moving to question one on page 10, does the board agree that the objective should be to encourage management to present its key performance measures inside the financial statements, where they'll be subject to greater transparency in audit?
Hi, Michelle, and by the way, as usual, a very well-written set of papers by the whole team. Is when you say encourage, you mean voluntary, it's not required, is that the intention? I mean, and it's key performance measures, and to clarify, what do you mean? Just various IFRS subtotals or non-GAAP or, you know, and how far do we go? Or is that, I didn't see that necessarily being developed at this point, but what are your thoughts?
And how far we should go?
Yeah.
I mean, it was mainly that, I mean, currently IFRS 1 requires additional subtotals where they're relevant to performance. And this would be more like to pick the maybe different types of measures that currently the subtotals in IFRS 1 have to comply with certain types of criteria. So bringing in the management performance measure would be introducing other kinds of measures as well that wouldn't necessarily adhere to those requirements. And also what we've heard is that although companies are currently required to present subtotals in the statement of financial performance, that they're not necessarily doing so because they feel that they have to justify those measures to regulators and auditors.
Yeah. And I don't disagree with it, you know, but encourage implies it's voluntary, you know, and then when it goes to key performance measures, there'll almost certainly be some that we can't accommodate. You know, it's one thing to exclude restructuring or put that below the line or a few things like that, but there's plenty of other examples or something that management views as a discontinued operation, IFRS standards do not, you know, that there's just no way to force fit it into the income statement. So I think certainly some key performance measures could be, but not all key performance measures could be. That's just sort of testing what you're thinking on.
Well, later in the staff proposal is if the management performance measure didn't fit into the income statement, then we would suggest it would be presented in a separate reconciliation.
Yeah.
So that would cater for that wider range.
And which, by the way, I do support that. Thank you.
I think that statement there is consistent with what we've been working on for some months, indeed some years. And I do think it implies that there'll be some choice, that some people will choose to have them within the income statement, and others will choose not to, and that will make the issue of the reconciliation very important. I think that there are multiple performance measures that the companies use, and that's why there needs to be this degree of flexibility about where they present them. But we also know that many companies don't have them in the financial statements at all. They have them very much in outside financial statements, in management commentary, in narrative sections, in press releases, and in investor relations packs. And that is part of the issue, that they aren't located within financial statements. So I do agree with this suggestion that that's our primary objective. I think there will be benefit in relation to the second part about persistence and so forth, which we will get onto. But I do think that captures the objective of what we're trying to do, make these things more visible and let people know where they can go to find them.
Nick?
Just really to follow up, looking at paragraph 16 and the two objectives that you lay out there, one to encourage preparers to present their key performance measures, and secondly to provide information about persistency or sustainability. Those two objectives aren't necessarily incompatible, but I would agree to prioritise the first objective over the second objective, as you suggest. I think, as Anne alluded to, perhaps users are looking for something a little stronger than encourage here, and where these are metrics which are directly related to profit and loss measures, so perhaps adjusted operating profit or adjusted net profit, they would definitely like to see that reconciliation or some form of reconciliation within the financial statements, rather than just being encouraged.
Yeah, I think the staff recommendation is require. I probably confused matters by saying that when the board discussed it before, we were considering whether to encourage or require it.
But the staff would require.
We're not talking about require here. We're talking about encourage.
Well, the staff proposal is require.
Require. I must say, after doing some more thinking about this, I'm very hesitant to go this way, because, by the way, is the idea that we are going to call it management performance measurement, or to give it one single name?
At the moment, that's the suggestion, but we can.
So we would have an item in the income statement with a name, which leads to widely divergent results, necessarily.
Excuse me, Hans. This is just in the financial statements. This is not in the income statement.
Not necessarily on the page.
We haven't read the format.
We haven't got to that. This bit. We haven't got to where.
Yeah, but it's somewhere. It could be in the notes or. But it would have the gain of this process would be that it will have to be audited, of course. And, and you draw something inside that is now completely outside our purview. Yeah. So that is, I see that gain. But I think we are sort of whitewashing something that is not comparable, that is very subjective. And even if we require all this reconciliation, and some of the proposals about presentation are not easy, I think there will be a lot of resistance from the regulatory community to this. I would rather go in the direction of perhaps requiring, if the idea is that we create a subtotal which the main purpose of which is to make a distinction between low persistence and high persistence, why don't we just ask them to do so? Require companies to do so? These are, as for example, subtotal of EBIT, I don't know, split EBIT in elements with high persistence, elements with low persistence, then you would, of course, have to develop guidance, which is not going to be easy. But I am really hesitant to pull something into the financial statements, which is so divergent, diverse. Give it one name and... Tom?
There were a lot of people before me.
I give you the floor.
Okay. It's funny, that wasn't my main issue. Coming back, why should we do this? I was reading, the CFA's put out an excellent document fall of 2016 where they surveyed their members on this issue, and there's been a lot of stuff out there on it. And I think... I'll also allude just a little bit to the SEC intervention in 2003 with Regulation G and the highly useful impact that had in the U.S. I think when you read the CFA document, they really would like, and I think all users would like, standard setters to take and do something on this issue. And with the analogy of the SEC ultimately controls, you know, everything about financial reporting, not just accounting. FASB exists at the pleasure of the SEC. So they've sort of done something about this issue. And so the fact that it's being done in the MD&A versus the statements, it doesn't matter because the SEC is sitting watching with its full authority. But we set standards for the world, and the strength of regulation, the strength of enforcement, all those things differ. And I think our users would like us to do something on this issue. And the other thing that I think we could do is if we go back to basically our raison d'etre, is we're supposed to be trying to enhance the information that users have to make decisions. And there's been a lot of attempts to fix the financial statements, and especially the statement of financial performance over the years. And I think we have two or three dimensions that we can look at fixing. One would be this sort of, you know, management's view. The other is persistence. There are even a couple of other things that we might bring in. There's certainly a lot of criticisms, all the ones about this association of performance with counting performance as produced by IFRS with stock returns and things of that nature. This would go a long way, I think, to really improving the information set if we get it right. As I think Anne pointed out, what's right will take a lot of work. Like, is it ideally in the notes? Is it in the statement proper? Like, how best to communicate it? What should be mandatory? What should be voluntary? But I think this is a really good opportunity for us to take a very hard look at improving the statement of financial performance or in the notes. Because unequivocally, and I think if we do the EBIT thing, if I do dimensions, my four big dimensions are probably financial operating, we do that. Okay, so we're working on that. The other huge one is trying to get some sense of either continuing operations or persistence or whatever you call it, but the one that you think is going to persist in the future. And this is an avenue to getting there. It's not a, you know, we have to kind of, there's a lot to decide between this management perspective and getting persistence right as you read the document.
If I might just interrupt, they might also just decide to leave out share-based payments.
Yeah. Sorry?
To just leave out share-based payments, something that comes back every year.
That lockbox management.
Oh, yes.
It has nothing to do with persistence, and which we hate.
That was one of the things, that was the second issue, was how much freedom to give management, which I'm not addressing now, because I think we should keep on the table, and really my view is, at a minimum, we should put out a really good discussion paper with all the avenues about how we can improve, what the choices are. And the staff have done a lot of excellent work. And I think we could create an improved product. So I would actually like to see us go forward, although, you know, I have on one or two questions, I think we may be moving overly quickly to a specific course, which I'll hold my comment on. But the fact that we should be doing something, I really strongly support.
Nick?
Just to come back on that and particularly pick up the about share-based payments. And I very strongly believe that those are part of performance measurement and they should be included. Yeah. But if we start putting rules around this saying that you can't have them in your management performance measure, we'll then have a non-GAAP management performance measure and it becomes a bit of a nonsense. We'll have another derivative on this. So I'm very nervous. I can see lots of the upside that Tom talks about, but I'm very nervous about putting rules. I think it's going to be very hard for us to define persistency or recurring. I would let the companies do that. And the way I would square that circle is to have a very full disclosure from a management performance measure or one of several performance measures back to our numbers. And that was the point about defining EBIT. So we could have an anchor somewhere else in the P&L so we could use that as a point which management can base their performance measure off. There's also value in those adjusting items. So if you sit there, and what typically happens is the analyst will sit there and say, actually, I'm not going to give them the benefit of share-based payments because it's ridiculous. Why should I? So we're going to put a line through that one, but I'm going to accept that this impairment is a one-off, and I'll allow them to add that back. By having that information, actually, there's information value in that list in its own right. Is this a business that every year is trying it on to put restructuring expenses through their non-GAAP numbers. That has information value. I can put a line through it in terms of my own analysis, but that's then my choice and judgment to do that. But there is information value. Do they not believe share-based payments are an economic phenomenon? There's information value in that as well. So I think it's all about really disclosure and a rich classification around, or reconciliation rather, around these measures, rather than just try and I wouldn't define or have us define a management performance measure at all, actually.
Well, I'm supportive of facilitating the bringing these non-GAAP measures closer and as close as possible to the income statement, and I'm saying the income statement, so providing already. So as close as possible, and to me the objective, I mean, you talk transparency and audit, to subject those to transparency and audit. I think altogether, to me, that's really bringing better consistency and understandability of financial information to users. I don't know whether I would have the audit part of the objective here. I don't know whether that's part of our job of having a view on that. But clearly, I think the closer we bring what are today non-GAAP aside measures more consistently related to what we require, in my view, increases understandability. I heard the discussion about encourage or require, and if it is a requirement to do something that may have different forms, I'm happy with the requirement, but I don't lose from sight the fact that the performance measure being defined by the entity that don't want to be, they have the possibility of defining it so that it appears where they wish that it appears. So we shouldn't fool ourselves too much about the strengths of a requirement. A requirement can help that something is done, but the entity that by defining the performance measure will in fact end up locating it where they feel it's best. So I heard a number of in the various discussion that we have in the past already, the recent past. I heard some pushback, and that made me think of yes, in the theme you're going to make non-GAAP becoming IFRS and have a better labeling. And I've been sensitive to these kind of arguments, but thinking back on the issue, I think today if I compare with today, we in fact require that additional subtotals, additional line items be provided, and that ends up being provided outside the financial statements. So basically, in our current requirements, we had given the possibility of performance measures defined by management being there already. It's just that the opportunity has not been taken, or that people have not understood that it was a requirement. So I'm not sure that as long as this fits clearly with the discipline that we put around it, I think that we have value to users. And on the second part of the issue is whether we agree that something is done around the persistence, in fact, to help. I agree that we do something. I don't know whether that is as much as a definition. I would appreciate if we could have on that issue some form of principle set out. Principle and discipline eventually more than a definition. Because a definition might at a point, point in time be arbitrary or create difficulties, whereas a good principle basis might be, with discipline might be a better guideline.
Martin?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that is the objective, that to include it, to have greater transparency and audit. I think it for me it depends. And if you would make it part of the performance statement, which I'm totally against that, because I think, and I have said it several times, because then we upgrading this kind of measures to an IFRS number. And then for me it is difficult, is it a non-GAAP number, is it a GAAP number? What does it mean for all the guidance which SEC, ESMA and other security regulators have given out? So is there not any requirement for reconciliation? Is it not a requirement to show these numbers with not more prominence than GAAP numbers? So for me it's then all confusing. So I cannot answer this question, not related to the second question, and how we do it. And yeah. If we do only a reconciliation of the management performance number to, I think, the next GAAP number, which we now develop, I think that is a reconciliation. And that is my understanding also what users want. They want to have more transparency how to reconcile and which exact numbers coming from the management to the next IFRS number. I think that for me is then the objective, what we should do. And all others, I think, man, if we have it part of the primary financial statements, also then I agree with Nick, because then we have to give discipline. But if we provide discipline, I think we users lose value on this kind of information, and why should be restricted? So it is not a management number, it is some in between an IFRS number and what management really thinks. So what is it? I don't know.
So you would not object to this reconciliation being part of the notes? Or?
I would say it's a separate statement or part of the notes, however we call it. But it is a reconciliation which not makes this management performance number to an IFRS number. And I think if we include it in the primary financial statements, for me it would become automatically an IFRS number. And how should we distinguish between these things? I don't know. And that is more me the most difficulty, because when I'm convinced that our primary financial statement is a kind of where we give the standards what should be included, what not be included, how it should be structured,
yeah,
and not the freedom of everybody how to do it. It is a different thing. I think it is information value, but we should not mix these things up. And therefore, I think a reconciliation would better perform what at least I have heard from users what their need is in this kind of non-GAAP performance measures.
I suppose I like this approach better, but then that is still reconcilable with what the staff has proposed. And I would also just like to draw attention to the fact that we have just written a conceptual framework in which we say that profit or loss is the key performance measure. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very careful into how we are going to define even or describe the management performance measure.
I would just add, you were saying that by having it on the primary financial statements, it in effect turns it into an IFRS number. Of course, having it in the notes would still make it an IFRS number, because it's then
no,
still
It is a reconciliation from an IFRS number to a non-IFRS management performance number.
Mm-hmm.
Not IFRS defined. That is for me really important, because I think I don't want to upgrade this sometimes stupid numbers to an IFRS number. Because if people think exclude share-based comp, for me it is would be a nightmare if that would be called an IFRS number. If that isn't kind of, they call it an operating performance number, and excluding this number, that is an IFRS number. And I as a board member could not live with that really. And therefore I think we have to make clear that okay, that if we include it in the financial statements, but this does not make it an IFRS number. So we don't upgrade this to an IFRS number. It is a reconciliation from the IFRS number which we now develop to this management defined, however. Because also I think in segment reporting, when they have their own measure, I would not see it as an IFRS number. The performance of a segment which is then defined by management. It is not an IFRS number. It is something defined by management, but not we have not given the standard size how what they should include, not include, allow what they include, not in. I think that is a difference, at least for me.
Chuck?
Thank you. I had words with the Japanese constituents this morning, and the Japanese constituents shared exactly the same view as Hans just mentioned, or Martin mentioned. Having said that, to me, I think the staff proposal is really improving, so I support staff's proposal. We discussed what is IFRS number and what is not IFRS number. Incorporating something strange into the financial statement is really odd. That's what the Japanese constitution says. So that's what the accounting standard setter shouldn't do. However, as Francois pointed out, in IS 1, we have paragraph 85, and we encourage to make a subtotal, which is just a subtotal, not really the completely out of the blue number. And also we have 85A and B to incorporate the discipline. So basic idea is already in the IS 1. And it is just for the better communication in order to make clear that what is what is the management emphasis on the performance. So it is done within the alternative performance measures world on unorganized basis. Some are in compliance with paragraph 85 and 85A, but some are totally completely different non-IFRS number with different measurement. So therefore, in order to clarify what is IFRS number in compliance with paragraph 85 and 85AB, then creating management performance measure will work, will improve the clarity of the numbers. And also, we have to think about the future development of a digital reporting, XBRL, taxonomy. And in order to make clear that the standardized number to be used by the data aggregators, I think having the number which can be authorized by IS1 or not is really important. And actually, it will provide lots of benefit in the future course of our primary financial performance.
Daryl?
So I think Nick said a lot of what I wanted to say, that I think this is a very necessary requirement. I think these non-GAAP reporting or this non-GAAP number is happening irrespective of whether we do anything about it. I think one of the reasons why it happens is in many jurisdictions, there's no governing of it. So you can essentially change from year to year what you want to do. You can do it in different ways. You don't have to reconcile, etc. And I think all of that means that there's numbers out there that are not being or subject to a discipline process. I think, and I probably agree with a lot of what Martin said in terms of, I think we need to very clearly label this for what it is. And it is, and again, to use a term that Nick used, it is about giving the user the opportunity to understand the way management sees the business and what they believe are the metrics that they see the business through. I would make the point that I think it is important that we require this. The objective behind this is to enforce a discipline, and that discipline is around things like transparency and reconciliation, also around audit, also around consistency of application. And I think if we were not to require it, I think companies would use any excuse they could not to do it. By requiring that you give this number and you reconcile and you constantly apply and you audit and you show it in your financial statements, I think we apply that discipline to the process. So I would and then to answer your question, yes, I think this is what we're trying to do.
Copying a lot of the guidance that securities regulators are issuing.
I think that's right. I think there are security regulators in the world who have done a really good job around this, and I think what we want to do is incorporate that.
But where would you see the logical logical place?
And that will come later, but I think there are two things here. I think having a separate reconciliation table, I think, is very useful. Yeah. But to Tuck's point, we must accept that for some people, this is a number that might already be on their income statement entirely compliant with IS1. Now, I don't think we can stop them putting it there. So I think if it complies with the requirements of IS1, then leaving it on IS1 is fine, and essentially it is reconciled. If it does not comply with the requirements of IS1, then essentially you push it into putting it in a table.
Martin?
For me, it is a problem, and still is IAS1. Based on my reading of IAS1, paragraph 85, man, to have an operating performance number which excludes share-based payment is allowed. Yeah, it's already allowed. And therefore,
it's already allowed.
I think it, my reading from IAS why is not allowed. I think my reading from IAS 1, 80, paragraph 85, it is allowed. If not, I'm fine, but my reading is it is allowed. And therefore, I think we have to do something about that, because I think that is would create a kind of gap number or an IFRS number, which I think does not make a lot of sense.
But you'd say that even being aware that they could do it right now.
They can do it already right now.
We need to stop them doing it somehow.
I think so.
I think so. In a different direction.
No, but I think it is okay, because man, we have not defined a kind of more subtotals, but we are doing it. We are in the process of doing
it. But if we would do that, if your reasoning is correct and your interpretation of IS1 is correct, then they would have, again, another reason to go to non-GAAP and do it all outside the financial statements.
Yeah, but for me that is fine. If somebody thinks he should bring a performance number excluding really a kind of necessary expense which they have, they could do it. Man, we could not stop doing people doing nonsense. Sorry to say that. But if we forcing them to give a proper reconciliation of all that number and ask them why they have doing that, then I think it is helping the process.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. I think, you know, I'm maybe Ken Pope, Hans, and maybe Martin and Tom. And the reason why I'm saying is the objective of this project is to reducing some kind of a non-IFRS measures or alternative measures presentation or disclosure. So in that sense, maybe we if you stick to the paragraph 16A objective, that is more focused on kind of a reliability, because we are asking them kind of a, any such information to be audited. And maybe this is a good idea. However, if we got some kind of a relevant information, then maybe such measures must be more kind of a information of a strong persistence. That would be more helpful for the investors to predict the future cash flow. So I'm thinking, you know, the objective of this project, if we reduce non-IFRS numbers, and if the management think that they're more relevant information for investors, then I think the paragraph 16B might be a more positive, effective. Another thing is, even though we allow this kind of a 16B objective, we should not require this kind of a performance measure, management by management, defined by management. So that's what I'm saying to suggest. Basically, in many Asian countries, there are no any alternative performance measures on the face primary financial statements in the notes. So I guess this phenomenon is quite popular among some, maybe, you know, some other regions. So basically, these countries would like to have a more, you know, more focusing on traditional performance measures. So if you introduce also a kind of EBIT, maybe we are using the different. I guess that sort of might be enough. And also there we have, as a top seven, you know, there is IS 185 already. We are, you know, allowing the all kind of subtotals if that complies with the IFRS. So in the case of this, you know, management to define some measures, we need to give us some kind of full flexibility rather than to be audited. We need to give some kind of their estimate on this kind of a performance. Maybe they think that's more persistent. So that's why I prefer the encouraging is better than the requiring these measures. So that's what I thought.
Sue?
I think I'm in the same place that Martin's in, because I see a tension between wanting to allow management to have a thing that they think is their performance metric on the face, because I think it would be a bit of a nonsense for us to sort of constrain that number, because then they're just going to use a different number somewhere else. Not going to solve the problem, but I'm nervous about sort of giving the apparent blessing of us allowing just a number without restriction on the face. So I think for me, having it somewhere other than on the face, so that it's in the notes and it's ordered to be reconciled and has to be done consistently and all of those things, is a helpful thing. So I think I'm in the same place as Martin.
One thing I do wonder, as we all talk about this reconciliation with such sort of confidence, is how good the reconciliations actually are that are provided today. I'd be interested in us having a look at that to see whether it's working and whether we need any more words to sort of bolster the level of disaggregation included within that. But I think I'd prefer on the face of the financial statements to focus on the EBIT, think about this persistence type concept as another form of disaggregation, but not to have a management metric there.
Mary?
Some fairly mixed reactions in terms of the discussions we've had. One is I just want to step back and say the work that we've done so far when we've been trying to define, build the requirements for an EBIT or EBIT-like subtotal on the face, I think are important and in some ways standalone from this discussion, because that's our effort to improve the usefulness of the statement of financial performance. And so I don't want to kind of cloud some of the things we've been talking about there. I think, I might not agree with every step, we're getting to a good place in terms of a robust construct to put out and thinking about how much is defined by us and how much is judgment. Then when I turn to the question of management performance measure, several things come to mind. One is persistence, one is the requirements of paragraph 85, and the other is what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is a management performance measure. And like Martin and others, I think if it is a management performance measure, it's got to be defined by management, not by us. And so if that's the case, let's stop trying to discipline it in terms of what you are allowed and are not allowed to put into it. And then it becomes a question of, if there is such a thing, where should it be presented? And I think it is, you know, the first question is if there is such a thing, because not every entity will have it, and we don't want to force somebody to make one up just to, you know, to satisfy a requirement. I think, and I think this is kind of what's behind the staff reasoning in question two rather than question one is, I think I would express it as the management performance measure can be included within the statement of financial performance only if it complies with IFRS recognition and measurement requirements. And so that doesn't prevent you from, you know, as you say, in some cases there may be a subtotal that is the management performance measure, and that's it. So I think it can be included within as a line item or subtotal there, and that I'm kind of taking as read the staff recommendation about not using columns for this. So, in that context, I think that's there. Now, in terms of should it be permitted or required somewhere else, I think I'm leaning more towards required rather than permitted, and I don't think I'd preclude the kind of thing that the staff illustrated in the appendix with a reconciliation below, but not inside of the statement of financial performance. And I think, and this is where I go back to statement 85 and what it says. Statement 85 doesn't give permission. Paragraph 85 gives a requirement, but that requirement is only in respect of line items and subtotals. It's not in respect of other information. And I think what occurred to me as I was thinking about this bundle of issues around management performance measures is that I think I'd start out with either a requirement or a rebuttable presumption, and this is something I could consult about, that says if it is important enough to discuss outside the financial statements, I think I'd have a presumption that it was relevant for, you know, how management looked at this was relevant for the financial statements, including how it related to the IFRS measures, which is what gets me to saying, so if you use it elsewhere, you have to include in the financial statements a reconciliation to an amount determined in accordance with IFRS recognition and measurement principles. Now, I probably would leave it to others to argue, you know, the point that Martin was making, where if we require it, does it automatically become an IFRS number? And I think I would express it as you have to reconcile it to an amount measured, you know, recognized and measured in accordance with IFRS. And I think I would start out with at least a very strong rebuttable presumption that if you use it elsewhere, you've got to put it in here and show how it relates to the IFRS amounts. But I would not constrain how you calculated it, because I want it to be actual management, you know, determination. If you can get there, you know, using the subtotals, then I think then I wouldn't preclude you putting it in the face. But when we talk about whether paragraph 85 permits or doesn't permit an entity to say operating profit excluding share-based payment, I think we're forgetting to bring in the other requirements that exist in IS-1 about whether you're doing it by nature or function. And the ability to make some of those subtotals is very much interacts with that. And so maybe that's something we have to pull together, because I don't think paragraph 85 is a straightforward permission to do that. It's 85 in particular, 85A put some constraints around it. So I would say I think we should say can't do it within the statement of performance unless it meets IFRS recognition and measurement requirements. I think you should be required to present it within the financial statements with a reconciliation to an IFRS measurement, an IFRS number. If it's not an IFRS basis number, and in terms of doing more on persistence, I really doubt. I wasn't here when the board pursued its financial, the FSP project. But I just really doubt our ability to make much more progress on it than we've made in the past. I'm really interested in how much we can do on disaggregation generally, which is not in this paper, and principles of disaggregation, et cetera, and that may help. But I think we could just run this whole project to ground if we make it necessary to try and at least develop and propose principles for determining what is persistence or high, medium, and low persistence. I think that could just be so difficult that it will derail everything else we're doing. So I have a lot of skepticism about our ability to accomplish that, and I want to put a caution around that. So that's kind of your part two of question one. And so that's the persistence, that's paragraph 85, and that's require linking it to this must be relevant. I think that's going further than paragraph 85 is now, because paragraph 85 is only about line items and subtotals.
So when you say, Mary, that when you say meets the recognition and measurement requirements, is that code for meets IAS-1? Because let's say, for example, that you couldn't argue for the particular entity that excluding share-based payments was relevant to understanding of the entity's financial performance. I still don't think that's contrary to the recognition and measurement requirements to strike your subtotal at a particular point.
I think there may be some entities, and I think they'd have to be doing their classification by nature to strike a subtotal before share-based payment. But if they, let's say, granted share-based payment to manufacturing, sales, and administrative employees, you couldn't have a function that said, SG&A, and then had share-based payments below that.
But that's not recognition and measurement, that's presentation. So you mean meet the requirements of IS-1?
Yes. I was trying to get back to the, is it an IFRS number or
not? I was trying to work out whether you just cared about things being measured differently, for example, but it's really, you meant something more subtle.
And subtlety is not my strong point.
I would say that, Mary. Don't underestimate your subtlety. Chen Chao.
Thank you, Alice. First of all, I agree that management performance measures can provide useful information for users. This is why there's so much demand for this kind of information. But secondly, when I read the paper and they say we are going to introduce MPM, as John said, that I'm from Asian country, because normally in practice currently, the prepared have not provided this kind of measure information in place. So as Hans and Martin said, first, when we introduce a new term or new measures, what we're talking about, what kind of number we're looking for, and whether we can define it, if we are going to bring it onto the face or in the financial statement, or even in the notes. I think we should, first of all, we should provide a clear definition or even principle-based definition, what kind of management performance
measure. Sorry, but are you telling me us that in China currently preparers do not use non-GAAP measures? Is that what you said?
Normally not too many, not yet, because they just comply with the standards and provide the information what standards require them to do. Yeah. So I think not very common, not very popular, yeah. So once we introduce the NPM, management performance measures, I think it's better to provide some meaning or definition what kind of information we're going to address, we're going to ask for them to provide. And so this the first question. And second, three, that I think that management performance measure should be the supplement to the gap, you know, based information. Not if we bring to the subtotals on the face, it seems that dominates or is a main part of the financial statement. So it's just based on the financial statement in place, and then it seems that it's not enough. So then we should provide a supplemental information for the users based on the management perspective. So this, I agree with the Martin point. If we lack this kind of information in the financial statement, it's better be disclosed in the notes. And finally, as Mary said, with regard to the recognition or measurement, I understand that if we are going to introduce this kind of subtotal, something like that, maybe we need to meet some recognition or measurement criteria. So, but I think that it should be a disclosure issue, yeah, not relevant to recognition and measurement issue. It will become very complicated issue if we go to recognition and measurement.
Anne?
I've heard a lot of agreement that people don't want this in the primary financial statements. I've heard a lot of people say they wouldn't be comfortable with a management performance measure in the primary financial statements. Many people think a reconciliation is really important, and that's been called for by users, and that reconciliation could sit in the notes. And then I've also heard that some people think it shouldn't even be in primary financial statements or notes. They should only be outside that, which was Han's original argument. They should be outside. So what we see at the moment is we see all those things. So we see listed companies that have these on the face, and they are audited. So their regulator and their auditor say that IAS 1 permits a non-GAAP measure on the face. So what do I mean by non-GAAP? Non-GAAP means not defined by IFRS. Now, some regulators define it differently, but for us, I think that's what we're talking about. I think we're saying that a non-GAAP measure, a non-GAAP subtotal, is not defined by IFRS. And that's why I think some companies can get these things on the face of the statement of financial performance, because they still comply. They're still IFRS, they've just backed out share-based payment, or they've backed out impairment. They're still all coming all out of an IFRS accounting information system.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've heard a lot of agreement, I've heard a lot of disquiet, uncomfortableness about putting it on the face or even mandating it on the face.
When you say you've heard, do you mean in today's discussion or more broadly?
Today's discussion, what I've heard around the room, is a lot of people wouldn't be comfortable with putting the management performance measure onto the face of the income statement.
I just wasn't sure which discussions you were referring
but
to.
But I also think we also hear that from our stakeholders. So if we go to the CFA studies that Tom's referred to, which are based on analysts in the UK and in the US, the majority of them don't want it on the face. When we ask our own CMAC members, there's various views, but if you try and get them to summarise, I think they say they're neutral whether it's face or notes, but they are the ones calling for the reconciliation and also calling for the transparency.
So ironically, when you read the staff's paper, you think we're going to add something that is now currently mostly outside the financial statements. We're bringing it in, calling their bluff, and requiring then reconciliation. But if I understand you correctly, if we went the way that Martin sketched, we would actually be more restrictive than currently is the case. Because I've also seen financial statements that started with non-GAAP.
Some places.
And where non-GAAP was even more prominent than GAAP, where finance leases were brought back to being operating leases and reconciled. So we could end up being more strict.
I don't think they can do that. Well, actually, meet 85 paragraph 85. That's not just a subtitle.
We've got to separate change compliance that's issues.
That's change.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And recognition.
Okay, Gary?
Thank you. The seems like about an hour ago, it was probably 15 minutes ago, Nick said something that I agreed with, and wanted to build on, but then as we slowly went around the room, I actually agreed with most of the comments. So I'm morphed into, okay, how would I do this, you know, in former life? I absolutely agree. I think if it's going to be a management performance measure, management has to define it. Now, I don't think we can define it, and I don't think we should. And if we did define it, and it's not in alignment with more than one company out there, they'll just redefine it themselves. I think that's counterproductive. So I think if we're going to go this route, we have to be prepared to accept management is going to define the performance number they want to look at. I agree. I would be very reluctant to put much, if any, of this stuff in the face of the primary income statement. It's not to say you might not be able to get there, and management might decide, hey, profit before tax as measured by IFRS is my performance measure. So you don't necessarily want to preclude it. Mm-hmm. And as I read IAS-1, I think it can be read to have an awful lot of different subtotals with and without convenient and inconvenient debits and credits. So if you look at IAS-185A, the first subtotal shall be composed of items made up of amounts recognized according to the IFRS. That's fine. Doesn't mean every number in the financial statements recognized and measured in accordance with IFRS in that subtotal. They could be below it. Share-based compensation is presumably an IFRS measured number, often try to exclude it or put to the side, but it is an IFRS measured number. It's just minimized, you know, if you will, in terms of its importance or prominence. On the other hand, a major restructuring or loss on asset sale could truly be non-recurring, fully measured in accordance with IFRS. That probably should be its own line item in a subtotal, excluding that sort of the persistent number. So again, for these reasons, I'm very reluctant to go into the P&L, whether we do a reconciliation or in the notes. I think we can probably work that out. I think for that matter, you could perhaps fit it in the IFRS 8 disclosures, because they've got a management number in there as well, and start with the cross-footing of the management performance number in the segment table, and then work from there. So there's many places I think we can accommodate it. I just don't think the primary financial statement for P&L should be the place we do it. I think another concern I've got, which hasn't come up, but it sort of comes up later in these papers and it's come up in earlier meetings, is we start thinking, I mean, how many subtotals on the face of the P&L are we talking about? You know, IBIT, you know, we've got proposal with and without, certain equity affiliates and so on. At some point, the P&L is a series of subtotals of very few line items there in it. So again, it's an optical concern, but I think it's a real concern, you know, when it's just a number of subtotal, one more number of subtotal, one more number of subtotal. I just don't think that's the way we should do it.
So probably at the end of our discussions, we have to take a look at which monster have we created.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to go into IAS-1 paragraph 85 and say it's written to be open-ended, but in practice it hasn't been, and I don't think we want to encourage it to start putting non-GAAP numbers without any sorts of restrictions or controls in it, certainly no more than we have today.
I note that we are basically, it was almost impossible to discuss question one and two separately, so taking them together.
Nick?
And that's why I wanted to come back, because our discussion has morphed into question two as yes. well. So just a few points to pick up on. I think, first of all, we don't want companies making up a number for the sake of it. So if you're not producing a non-GAAP number today, we are certainly, I don't think, requiring that of companies. Secondly, there may be more than one management performance yeah. measure, and that actually makes having the measure on the face very complicated as well. You may want to adjust at the operating level. You may have some further adjustments within investing or financing. So you may actually have two measures. The third point I'd say is that one of the big frustration of users is let's take an adjustment at the operating level. They want to see how the impact feeds through to EPS. Some of these adjustments can have very different tax consequences. Unless you understand those right through to the bottom line, it's very hard to make sense of that number. I remember a Swiss company very well gave me a very nice adjusted figure for amortization of intangibles at the operating level, left it there, almost hanging. You didn't really know what to do with it. So it needs to be taken down to EPS, and that really continues to support the reconciliation.
That's a problem.
The reconciliation. It does, but I think we need to think about that.
Because incremental EPS on line items, yeah. in my experience, your big debate is the effective rate with or without, is
yeah.
it the statutory rate, is the
yeah.
country rate,
yeah.
And so on, and there is no one answer.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
I get left preferring the reconciliation, and whether it's notes at the bottom of the finance or the performance statement, I don't really mind where it is. And just in terms of looking for examples of good practice that Sue asked about, I think actually the US is a good place to look, because this is quite a well-established procedure in terms of providing non-GAAP measures and providing a very rich reconciliation at various levels down the P&L.
Tom?
Okay, I think I have many issues. I'm going to try and do two. First one is, one of the things I have a problem with is just the question we're answering at this point. My view is, how do we provide the best information to users? We've jumped to, do we need a management performance measure? I think there were some other alternatives that could have been looked at the same time. In fact, even going back a little bit of this, on two things, two pieces of evidence. The US evidence with their intervention into non-GAAP, up till the intervention, these measures were seen as opportunistic. They tended to be used less by users, and they didn't correlate very well with returns. Then the SEC intervened and it stuck in three things, two of which we can do. Ask for a really good reconciliation, and it asked for consistency year to year or period to period, and they said, we're going to enforce. So those two things, and plus the enforcement, I don't know, bought actually a big improvement in the quality of the non-GAAPs. The following things happened. The number of non-GAAP items reported fell. The relevance of the non-GAAP numbers went up. Some firms that had been disclosing really opportunistic numbers ceased to do it because they were exposed as basically being an opportunistic group. And almost everybody who's analyzed this has done this on the opportunism informativeness dimension. Could be two dimensions, I'll keep it one. So one pole is opportunism, one is informativeness. And so if you viewed the U.S. in 1995, it was pretty close to the opportunism. The SEC moved it a long way toward informativeness. But no one believes they're all the way to being fully informative. Okay, so that's the first thing. So even if we go for, if we grab those two items, reconciliation, consistency, we're going to leave room for a lot of opportunism, and we're missing the third. To some degree, unless we put in, this is my next point I'm going to come to, in fact, I'll come to it now. The way it's been described, it's almost like we have a choice between giving management, other than those two restrictions, total freedom versus a very narrow rules-oriented constraint on them. Well, in that space, there's a lot of alternatives. We could write some principles. We could write some logical groupings. We could do a lot of stuff there. I don't think we should sort of just say it has to be the management one without exploring how might we legitimately, in very limited way, constrain this to improve quality. I think that question should be out there front and center before we go much farther. So the second piece of evidence also, which bothers me a little bit with the MPM choice, is on that CFA study. And a small point, just for the record, it was a global survey, not just UK and US.
I would disagree with that, but we'll take that on.
I just read it.
You'll fight about it.
Okay, all right. Just for whoever is interpreting it. All I could read was global, maybe it was something else. And by the way, Anne has, so a lot of our evidence is based on U.S., by the way, Anne has an excellent set of papers on world stuff that's worth reading. But if I go back to the CFA study, one of the questions they asked to the people was, first of all, one of the things they said, limit opportunism. That came through loud and clear. The second thing they said, well, they said this many, many times, but one question, they gave them 10 choices about what they would want to see for this non-GAAP measure. And they had 10 choices, and you could answer all 10 if you wanted, so it wasn't sort of pick your best. Interestingly, the first three are all about earnings quality, facilitating forecast, which is all the persistent story, first three. The fourth one is they don't like the GAAP treatment, so fix it. We'll give you some latitude to fix it. The fifth one is understand performance through the eyes of management. And again, I'm not sure why this has jumped right to the head of the class. CFAs have it fifth. It may be that we have to go there. I think there's a lot of good reasons to getting there. And in fact, that may be where I want to go. I'm just not sure I want to go there now. And then the last thing I think I wanted to make on, could we do something with persistence? And we have a ton of evidence, and Lev will be at the ICAEW Monday, and we can hear him. There are a lot of people, every time we go out at the recent ASAF, somebody quotes that. Everybody talks about our numbers becoming less relevant. And what we're finding is over time, analysts are using these things more, and they're better associated with returns, and that is because there's somehow some of the persistence is coming through in that number. Has to be. So somehow there's something happening with persistence that everybody else can sort of discern. Secondly, with respect to can we figure it out, most academic studies will do logical groupings and kind of split on persistence to some degree. Analysts seem to choose to be able to split on persistence. Data aggregators like Compustat produce an operating income that splits on persistence. And even if you look at Morgan Stanley did a study where they said, if you take a look at what works best in terms of information for price, they actually somehow got the data where they took the non-GAAP measure, factored in user adjustments like what they didn't like, and they got a better correlation. So the analysts seem to know what's in there that isn't so persistent. And so before, again, we throw up our hands, I don't know what's happened in the past, and say we can't do anything with persistence, I'd like to take a look at all these people who are doing something with persistence. Because I think I'm going to come back. I think we can, at the end of the day, if we really work studiously at this, produce some information that will genuinely enhance our financial performance reporting. And I'll make one last comment. I think I will make a bit of an analogy for the management performance measure to the operating segment. I mean, that was in some sense how we got an operating segment note in, was we had to go to acknowledging that management had a role to play. And I suspect that we would run into exactly the same thing. Management have a role to play. I'm not convinced it should be a fully unconstrained role, save the reconciliation and the consistency. I'm probably lean toward minimalist stuff, but I'd like to investigate it.
I hope the name of the SEC has not been used in vain.
No, it's fine.
Just one question, quick question to Anne. You said non-GAAP subtotal. So what did you mean that? Say, for example, if MPM excludes share-based payments, do you call it a non-GAAP? The share-based payment is calculated based on IFRS number.
Yes.
So they just changed the subtotal number.
Yes.
And the paragraph 85 already said if subtotal number is necessary or useful, then you can provide your own subtotal.
But yes.
And probably non-IFRS defined, right?
Yes, so non-IFRS defined subtotal.
Yeah, but we do not define lots of subtotals.
No, we don't. So
non-IASB defined.
Okay.
So a lot of people will give us an operating profit subtotal or an EBIT subtotal, and they are presently undefined in IFRS.
Yes.
Right? They're just an undefined IFRS. And then they would adjust that as well by taking out impairment.
Yeah.
So they'll go, here is underlying EBIT, here's impairment, yeah, and here's EBIT.
Yeah.
So the adjustment is an IFRS number, and the subtotal is comprised of IFRS numbers, but they're undefined.
Yeah, yeah, but because we do not define many, so that's what we are going to define. Yeah. So we are going to define EBIT.
Yeah.
Not define, but somehow describe what the EBIT. So then there are some people who are not very happy with our description of EBIT. Then we are going to give an opportunity to show the different type of EBIT, not EBIT, but a different type of performance measure. So therefore, if we call it something like undefined, then we have to really strictly define what the performance measure is all about. But we, in a sense, we gave up doing that. But instead, we provide some comparable measure which everybody has to comply. However, it may not fit with your performance measure. In that case, you have a chance to provide information to users, and which would be also useful to the user. That's what we are saying. So therefore, I'm confused because you're saying not many people are happy with having a non-GAAP subtotal. So that's kind of, statement misleads the idea what we are talking about.
I said that I could hear around the table that many people don't want to make mandatory putting the management performance measure into the statement.
I see. Okay. That is, yes.
I don't hear support generally for that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Françoise?
Well, I wanted to eventually highlight some perspective in this discussion where we are in the tentative decision that we have made. We're talking, with the decisions that have tentatively been made by now, basically this management performance measure would necessarily be a subtotal above what is in effect an operating profit that we have tentatively decided not to call that Y, but that in effect is an operating profit. So that it's not as if we were still in the vacuum in which we are today. We have already agreed a number of subtotals that have to remain comparable, that cannot be adjusted on the face. So it's just the only opportunity would be to present something which is, eventually called operating profit before, adjusted or management performance measure, if that was the name to be given to that line. So I think we over-exaggerate, and that fact associated with the current guidance in IS1 about subtotals and the discipline that is put around it. I think we over-exaggerate in the perception we have of how much latitude is left to doing bad things. And so we also alluded to whether today it was possible to draw a line of operating profit before, for example, share-based payment. The guidance that has that guides the discipline of not doing that today is not in IS1, it's in the basis for conclusions to IS1. And I think we could absolutely make it more visible. So I think if the management performance measure sits well, naturally well, within what we have left undefined, I think it would bring proper emphasis, proper transparency to users without misleading anybody, because you would have to still stick to the discipline of labeling in a descriptive manner, and anyway the operating profit could not be adjusted because that would be one of our measures already. Now, I would like, I mean, the parallel has been made briefly to IFRS 8. I mean, in IFRS 8, you can have numbers which are not in line with IFRS, which, with whatever lines, whatever definition you wish, that do not necessarily provide a very deep understanding, and nobody has said this is not compliant with IFRS. So...
No, because it's very specifically a management perspective.
So if you define a management performance measure as being management approach to having a performance measure, and in the same manner, Nick referred to multiple management performance measures, but basically this has to be something which would be a subset of operating profit to sit in the performance statement. Otherwise, it would be a reconciliation, necessarily.
Yeah, that was very thoughtful. But could the staff give a little bit of comment at this point?
Can we take any decisions?
You mean?
Well, I don't like voting on that objective unless I know where it's going to turn up.
Is this a rhetorical question? Or?
But are people being swayed towards the objective being to introduce management's view of performance?
Michelle, I think it's really hard to vote on question one because you've given us good papers, they're all logically set out, and we've just jumped here and here. That wording of that first part of question one opened up all that other stuff, so I think it's really hard to vote on that.
Unless what you're asking us to agree is that we don't think it should be a number that's defined by us and that's specifically about persistence.
If
you flip it around the other way, then I could answer that. But I can't answer question one without knowing where you're then going to put it because I get nervous.
I mean, perhaps if we do flip it around the other way and say that if we were to go down the route of doing a management performance measure, is our objective to it comes back to the constraints we want to put around the management performance measure. One constraint is to say that actually what we wanted to do with the management performance measure is to provide some sort of indication of persistence. And if we go down that route, we're going to have to come up with some sort of definition or some sort of guidance around what we mean by the term persistence. I think that's one route we could go down. The alternative route, which is I think the way that the staff papers have been set out, is that actually what we're wanting to do is to give management the flexibility to define their own management performance measures because we think that has some information content and it has some advantages in terms of audit, etc. Audit and additional transparency that we could introduce to that. So the question is, between those two extremes, where is the board sitting? Do you want to place restrictions around the management performance measure and perhaps try and portray persistence, or are you happy to look at some sort of management performance measure that effectively management is free itself to define?
And I think our answer is it depends where it turns up.
Is that not the second question?
Second opinion.
I don't want to answer the first one because I don't want to say yes to something I don't
want. Can I make a suggestion about a different way to think about the question given the discussion we've had? One basic question I think we all agree with, but it's perhaps worth confirming, is do we think we should address management performance measures in this project, in the work that we do? Or are they just out? And I think everybody, but maybe just confirm first that we want to try and do something addressing management performance measures. Yes. Then, assuming that you get a yes on that, I think the second part that brings up some of what is in question, the first part of question one, is for those management performance measures that, I'm not going to say whether they are today or are not today, but are inconsistent with the requirements of IFRS's standards, especially IS 1 paragraph 85.
Can I take one step back? Because I think the second question is a bit implicit in the paper, but I think if we require it, how do we require it? I think what the staff wants to say is, well, if you use it outside the financial statements, we require that you bring it somewhere.
Well, that
to be seen later in the financial report. Yeah. That is the second question. which we have not discussed, but I think that's where we have to go. Otherwise, you cannot require.
Which is going to open the whole can of worms. We're dealing with an IFRS 8 about how far do you have to look for where that number is to require it to be.
Yeah, but how else can you require it? Are we going to require? They can obviously just say if our performance measure is profit or loss.
Yeah. But then it's hard for them to use something else outside the financial statements without having to explain why.
Yeah.
And I think that creates, if I'm going out and saying core headline earnings is my measurement, oh, but by the way, that's not my I think I'm having to tell a very difficult story.
Yeah.
That's what I say. You require to either identify it within the income statement or reconcile to it.
Yeah.
That's.
And that's what I'm trying to get to. The second question is, you know, the first is, should we do something about MPMs? Which then leaves us in the question of what. And I think what you are honing in on is, if it's something that's not consistent with the current requirements of IFRS standards, and therefore could not be presented on the face, the thing that I hear everybody hearing about is, should we look at it at requiring a reconciliation?
In the notes.
Yeah. Within the financial statements, mm-hmm. You know, taking in baby steps. And you know, if you maybe ask those two questions, I think at least in replacement of question one, that might at least give you some sense. And then I think the third question is the one you identified is, should we do additional work to look to see about providing information about persistency? And I think that's something you may want to look at is either within or outside management performance measures. Because, you know, if the MPM doesn't itself do persistency, I think you're going to get a split in the board between whether we should start trying to constrain that or whether we just have a separate objective about information about persistency.
The reason I didn't put it that way around, and we can put it that way around, is that I think if you went down a route of saying, well, what we want to do is to give information about persistency, I think that perhaps gives you some different answers. So, for example, I think we could say, well, actually, we want all companies to give this subtotal on the face of the financial statements because we actually think it gives useful information about persistency. So I think it actually drives to some different answers to some of the other questions that we're posing.
Maybe, but I think also you could have a situation where the information about persistency is a disaggregation question on the face and not even necessarily anything to do with subtotals. And in addition, if they had a management performance metric that they were using that doesn't meet the requirements in paragraph 85, then that would be what would be provided in the notes with the reconciliation.
So then effectively we'd be looking at two different types of information, additional information that we'd be looking at as part of the PFS, one to do with persistency and the other to do with the management performance measure.
Mm-hmm. Well, or...
Because I think they're meeting different objectives. I think that if we really believe, and Tom's done a good selling job ever since he's been on the board, that the pieces of information we should care about are this distinction between operating and financing and persistency, I don't know if that's Tom's word, but that... and we really believe that, then we can use our EBIT subtotal and disaggregation to do that. And then the separate question is, do we need to do something to try and put some sort of discipline around these different management metrics with reconciliations, audit, and all of these things as well?
Well, so would, sort of two wouldn't in practice many of these MPMs have an element of persistence? And then we could also say, if your MPM has an element of persistence,
you're done.
Then no.
Well,
you give some guidance as to how they should give the disclosures which give evidence that indeed there is low or high persistence.
I just think that could be complementary, arguably.
Thank you. I would strongly advise against trying to force fit this into the primary statements, making a stronger statement than earlier. I don't think we'll ever get done with the project, because if you really have to define a management profit number, however, I think once you're on the face of a primary statement, although of course you should be consistent and comparable, but now you're into defining accounting policy to be consistently applied, to change its preferability letters and so on, and I just cannot envision the world, even a sizable minority of the world, coming to closure on a definition. I think will never get done. I think whether it's in the notes or separate reconciliation given, let management define it however it does, disclose how they defined it and why, and then give the numbers, I think we have a much greater chance of moving it forward. Because I do agree, a measure of management's view of the results, and we've got an IFRS 8, and maybe that does the job anyways, you know, but maybe get to do more. I think that's important to do, but we're never going to get done if you're trying to make it fit in the face of P&L with our definition, whether rules-based or principles-based definition. And likewise, I don't think we should make it so open-ended. And again, back, because you won't be able to capture everything under with an IFRS number or can be recognized or measured thing and so on.
It seems to me there is a strong preference for a reconciliation over on the face. That's the tone I'm picking up. There is still the issue that Martin raised, where you have the non-GAAP issues today effectively on the face as subtotals. And clearly there is an obvious reconciliation to some of those subtotals already because they are subtotals, so by definition. But my frustration is they don't go all the way, they don't trickle all the way down to the EPS.
Well, that's
level.
An additional. That's
but
an
it
additional
is, but just
app,
another
so
reason not to do it.
So it makes me more in the very much in the reconciliation camp. But just to say that issue is still out there with the subtotals that appear today.
Tom.
Sorry, I forgot to take it down.
So, could you summarise the conclusion? Have we reached that conclusion?
I can certainly tell you what you think, whether you agree or not, it doesn't matter. Could we ask a question? It seems to me there is some sort of consensus around the idea of having some sort of management performance measure as a reconciliation in the notes. Is that something that...
Can I rephrase that for you? I think there's some agreement around having a reconciliation between a management performance measure and an IFRS defined measure. Right?
Don't do that.
I think there's an agreement around a willingness to have a desire to have a reconciliation from the management performance measure that some managers choose to present somewhere and an IFRS defined number.
Yeah,
I think that.
Well,
measures.
I think what we agree on is we would require preparers to identify their MPM.
If they have one.
If that is just profit or loss, they're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. They say it's profit or loss. Mm. No further work.
They're done.
Yeah. I think that Françoise said if it can sit naturally on the income statement and it reconciles naturally, then you're also done. If it doesn't fit, then you have to do a reconciliation in the notes.
Why
in the notes?
Well, you have to do
reconciliation.
Huh? Let's talk about where.
I think
you get
reconciliation in the financial
statement.
Then you do a reconciliation.
Okay,
so now the next question is where do we reconcile?
Should we have a vote for the notes? And this is ones that aren't fitting naturally on the face already.
Yeah, can I just say something to that? Like Françoise says, there's times where they fit naturally, and they do, because it's just a line. It's just, I know we're going to have
requirements around those, so we don't have to worry about that.
No. I think we have not discussed really the merit of the staff recommendation, which is to have eventually the reconciliation sitting below the statement of performance. That before we take the vote, it would be good if we could consider that that possibility.
So we have arrived at question two. We haven't discussed all the alternatives yet. So perhaps you would like to summarise.
Okay, so shall I go? We're going to take a vote on question two.
So we have answered question one.
We voted on a modified question and we agreed.
Okay, so when we first introduced the management performance measure in March, we recommended that it should be presented as a subtotal in the statement of financial performance. However, in September, because the board decided to prioritise subtotals that facilitate comparisons between companies, such as EBIT, over bringing in a management performance measure, and also bringing in an income and expenses from investment category, this additional proposed structure would add more constraints on the management performance measure. So this is what prompted the staff to consider different locations for the management performance measure, and also the board is recommending some different locations at the last board meeting. So moving to question two on page 18, does the board agree? I think how I should phrase this.
I don't think we're voting on that first sentence now, because we changed question one and we voted. So are we just voting on something to do with the location of the reconciliation?
Yeah. I think that's right, because I think the staff proposal was that we should put the reconciliation at the bottom of the statement of financial performance. Most of the discussion that we've been having around this has been actually we should have it in the notes. And so I suppose we have a basic question. Do you definitely want it in the notes, or is there any support for the staff proposal to put it at the bottom of the statement of financial performance?
So like approaches two and approach four. And approach three and approach four.
And by posing that question, I'm assuming from a lot of the discussion that there's no appetite for the other alternatives that we put within the note, which is, for example, through the use of columns.
Françoise?
Well, I'm in support of the staff recommendation on this one, because I think it brings better visibility, and it helps meet the objective of bringing better understandability to users. So that.
So Françoise, that's approach three. You're in support of approach three.
Approach one is already dealt with.
And why do we have to decide it today?
Yeah.
And I would even prefer more to, when we discuss how this reconciliation should look like in detail, and maybe we have also then adding some of other persistence items, not one. When we have decided all that, then I think location discussion makes more sense. Because I think we all agree it should not be part of the performance statement. Mm. If it's below or in notes, I'm...
Things are long.
Don't care.
I'd support Martin in that. I think we can leave location. We've made an agreement. I think we can leave location, because then we've got the chance to think about some other things, which is to do with EPS, which is to which number we start at, because some people don't start at the EBIT line. They start at operating profit line in terms of their reconciliation. And we are going to do work on disaggregation and by function and by nature. So we've got that other work that we're still doing. So I would support that we didn't.
Just to answer your question.
Can I go back to what required means?
It would be that they're required to present their the management's view of performance. And as Hans said, if their management's view of performance is profit or loss, then they don't have to go any further than that.
How do we know if they've got a management? So the reason why I'm asking this question is because of the feedback that we've got on IFRS 8. Mm. So on IFRS 8, we said if you had a different split of segments in the annual reporting package, which is your investor presentations or anything else, then you have to bring that into the financials or explain why not. So prima facie, it would seem that the same argument could be used here, that if you're using a management performance metric in that package, which includes investor presentations in particular, that you should be using that. That should be what triggers the requirement to bring it in. So I'm just worried about the feedback I know we've got on that proposal in IFRS 8, which I don't think we should ignore.
We could just say you are required to state, is that, by the way, going to be the COPD? Anyway, you are required to state which number you consider to be your management performance number.
Can I ask a question?
You can pull it from wherever you want, but then...
But the problem is they might say my number is profit or loss, so then they don't have to provide the reconciliation and everything. They just keep doing it in their investor presentations and we haven't achieved our objective.
But the question is, man, do we want to have a reconciliation? Many companies have a key performance metrics, which they use internally.
Yeah.
That is also, I think, when we have the management commentary practice statement, we say, please discuss your key performance metrics. But I think, do we, if they're using that internally, do we require reconciliation to the IFRS number, or only if they're using that for external communication of the results? I think we have to decide on that. What does might make more sense? Because I think it's a total difference if you look in what is your operator, your key performance metrics defined by management, and what you're using in external communication. If we're discussing, do we require yes or no? Do we require only if it's used for public communication of results, or do we also require if it is used internally to measure management compensation or whatever? And many people using a key performance metrics to give a basis for management compensation, for share-based payment, all this kind of stuff. Do we require, if they're using that only for this purpose, then also require doing that in the... We have to discuss it. It's difficult to...
I mean, one of the things that we were going to be discussing at the next meeting, once we established what our objective was, which was that should the management performance measure be required or allowed, and what sort of restrictions would you put around that? And so would you put... Yeah, would you put
okay,
things
so shall
in
we
there?
Yeah. Let's pause yeah. here. Yeah.
But let's
yeah.
make sure that we've looked at the feedback on the IFRS 8 ED, because I think it's pretty relevant.
But on this, I think there's both an opportunity to build on that, and especially, and I think we haven't decided yet, if this project ends up going with a discussion paper as its first consultation, because I think the feedback that we heard on the IFRS 8, and let me start by saying, IFRS 8 amendments would have probably been perceived as a more targeted, limited audience response than something as broad as primary financial statement structure. I think the division of views in IFRS 8 was between what we've done historically, which is saying looking within the annual report, versus what we call the annual reporting package, which expands the report itself to go to other stakeholder communications. And it was that tension of going beyond the annual report. So I think one thing we could probably start with is, I hate to curse it, but reasonably safe is, you know, if it's used elsewhere in the annual report itself. And we could use, especially if we're doing a DP, that opportunity to say, if this is what, you know, if the objective that you laid out long ago in the sunny days when you thought we were going to vote on question one was drafted, that the objective is to bring more rigor and discipline around things that companies use, we could ask a question in that context about, is it operational to go further? I don't think we'd go as far as anything external, because you have debt covenants, as Martin said, you might have comp arrangements that are made public, etc. But you know, exploring further that tension. But I think we can also tie it back to the concept that underlies paragraph 85, without arguing that it's in paragraph 85 today, which is, if it's so relevant that you use it to communicate about your performance, and maybe that's the extra point we need to make, it's so relevant that you use it to communicate your performance to stakeholders, then how it relates to your IFRS amounts is relevant information. But I think it's an expansion, it's a parallel, not reinterpreting what that says today. But I think it's just that focus of annual reporting package. That's where we got most of the pushback on IFRS 8.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think a little bit of the pushback was also the location of any kind of discussion. So if IFRS 8, if your segments comply in the notes, then if you're trying to describe why the disclosures of the notes are different from something outside, like management commentary, is that disclosure appropriate for the financial statements, or is that disclosure more appropriate for something outside the notes?
Which I think will be the same thing people might raise here.
Yeah.
I don't agree with the argument, but I think we'll have
to... I think we'll just have to face that. I don't see how else you can do it. Gary?
The only thing I'm actually certainly don't want is columns. I could be had, whether it's on the face of the primary statements or the notes. I think you can make good arguments in either direction. If I had to pick a choice right now, I'd probably say on the face of the P&L, but then you get to, well, is it a separate statement? Is it part of the P&L, or is it just a table that happens to be on the same page? And I think Mark said, I think we're right, probably need more discussion on it. And then he raised the question, is this above or in front of or underneath the OCI table, and so on. So I think there's more pieces to it. That said, I think whatever number management points to is the management measure should be a number that's someplace in the annual reporting package featured prominently when you're talking group-wide results. Is that what implies it's in the management commentary someplace, because that's what it's supposed to be through the eyes of management discussing the business as you see it. So it seems entirely logical that's the go-to place. Now maybe there's rebuttal presumption it could be someplace else, but then you got to raise the question why you're focusing and featuring that in the management commentary. So I think it should be we have to
Because we succeed in reconfusing ourselves every time that we are close to a consensus, and I believe we are close to a consensus. So, Rachel, we're not going to vote on the second question.
I think that's fine. I think we have enough to sort of go away with and work with. We have a general support for doing something around a reconciliation of the management performance measure, of a management performance measure to the amounts that are included in the statement of financial performance as defined by us, and that we still have an open question. I think there is a general acceptance that if that management performance measure fitted logically into the structure of the IFRS of the statement of financial performance, then we're happy for it to be on the face. If it doesn't fit logically into that structure, then we need to think about where else that would go, whether that would actually be in the notes or whether it would be below the statement of financial performance. We also need to think carefully about what it actually means to require that management performance measure and whether we need to have some sort of how to do it. Yeah. And there are lots of other sort of associated questions with that. I think we still have a question that's open around persistence and whether we want to do anything around persistence in that area, but perhaps we take that off the table for now and we bring that back to a future meeting.
Yes.
Are we coming back to EPS at a future meeting?
The plan is to, yes. But we wanted to get this management performance measure bottomed out before talking
about
that.
Let's leave it at this and move on to the second paper.
I have a footnote to add to that, not reopening that. But the staff has a statement at the end of paragraph 3 that based on your analysis, you're not planning to, this is not a ban on the use of columns. I'd like to ask you to go away and think about that, because to me, if we've concluded that you can't use columns for management performance measures, I don't see any other use that they would have. So I think, in effect, that is a ban, but there may be some flaw in that logic, and I think we should not leave that hanging out there as an uncertainty. But I think that's a footnote to the discussion we're having. It doesn't affect the decisions we made.
I didn't catch your point.
It's the sentence at the end of paragraph 43. I can explain it further later. I just wanted to flag that as an open point.
If we are going to bring this forward by stating that we are going to ban APMs, we could just as well bury the whole project. Because first of all, I don't think we are going to.
Columns.
Columns.
Last sentence, paragraph 43.
But you have to stop discussing.
Last year before.
It's going.
Okay. Let's just change the subject to the statement of cash flows. Maybe it's easier. So agenda papers 21B to 21D focus on targeted improvements to the statement of cash flows. So agenda paper 21B provides background information and an overview of papers 21C and 21D for this meeting. So if you agree, I'm going to skip this any comment on this first paper on the introduction. And let's move on to agenda paper 21C, which explores the removal of options for the classification of interest and dividends in the statement of cash flows. So in this paper, we are explaining what the problem is. And the problem is that paragraphs 34.57 statement of cash flows allow entities to choose how to present cash flows arising from interest and dividends, and this choice has led to diversity in practice. So in our analysis of issue 1 in paragraphs 19 to 21, we provide some compelling reasons why the board should remove options for classification of cash flows from dividends and interest and prescribe a single classification. We think that removing these options will reduce diversity in practice and provide more comparable information. So the first question we're asking the board, before we discuss more specifically the classification for interest and dividends, is whether the board agrees to remove the existing options for classification. So in general, do you agree regarding the removal of options for classification? Do you agree with this initiative?
Yeah, no, I fully support the removal of options just for the simplicity of being able to find information, not having to search in the cash flow statement for different items. It's a very sensible proposal.
I'm support of eliminating options, but I mean, paragraph 21 raises some alarm. I personally don't have necessarily knowledge about how a different presentation of interest and dividend could make sense. You know, when you refer to flexibility of entities, if there was really a difference in business activities that can explain a different presentation, I would not want that to be forbidden. In other words, if you have evidence that this flexibility is used in order to distinguish in between different business activities, then I think there would be, there should be the requirement to present in accordance so that these differences are reflected. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's eliminating the free option, I support. But if you have evidence that there is difference in business activities, then I would want to have the requirement of different business activities being reflected, which in my view is a good protection against uniformity and enhances comparability. So it's the way paragraph 21 is explained.
But then are we going to have to define what the different business activities are?
I mean, we would have to indeed have identified them, but it's suggested that they may exist in paragraph 21.
Well, it's just that also the main assumption in this paper is that we are referring to non-financial entities, but obviously the classification may change. Well, the classification may change for financial institutions, but still we might think about removing options also for financial institutions. So we are recognizing that there might be differences in the different businesses. They would require different classification, but I think that what we are saying is that there is a need to remove the options either.
The need to remove the option, I agree.
Okay.
But if we are aware that there are different business activities, I think they should be reflected. And in my view, that's no longer an option.
Okay.
Yeah, you're saying okay very lightly there, but it's very different to what I thought you were proposing.
No, I mean, I understand.
I think Françoise is perhaps talking about within the context of a, let's say, a manufacturing company. If that manufacturing company has different business activities which might drive it to want to classify dividends and interest differently, then you would say that there should be a requirement to classify those differently. I don't think that was our staff proposal.
No.
Our staff proposal was that we would remove all choice from that all dividends and interest for that company would be reported in a single place.
Yeah, I'm in the same line as that. It's just I was thinking that perhaps you were thinking about non-financial institutions, but I don't think it would be valid for an entity, for a manufacturing company, to have different options for classification.
That's why I say I don't have knowledge.
So it depends how you read in the word option, doesn't it? So one way of reading the word option is just saying that for every, let's say, every manufacturing company, they have to classify interest and dividends in a particular way.
Yes.
That's one approach. I think that's what you were
suggesting. That's what we are suggesting,
What Françoise is saying is that today it's just a free choice, which she thinks is wrong.
Yeah.
But what she would like is that in particular circumstances, you would classify it this way, and in particular circumstances, you would have to classify it that way. And so there'd be criteria, and if you met the criteria, that determines classification, but it could be different classification if your circumstances are different, which is different to what you propose.
And we do not support that, yes.
Well, you have left the point on GVs open.
Well, it's not that we have left. Well, that doesn't mean that we will well, it's just that's something that we still need to discuss.
Okay. So
This might be related to Françoise's concern. So if you see paragraph 16b, UKFRC got a good suggestion, is cash you received from customers, including any amount as an interest. FRC just suggested it be classified as operating. So that's maybe, you know, the Francois idea is removing option is okay. However, interest is some kind of thing might be classified as a interest maybe received maybe as a operating activity. Interest is received as a financing activity. So these are two types of interest, maybe some kind of paid or received. That's what maybe Francois is saying, right?
Well, it's the type of thing. I mean, in that example, I think we identify that if you get a financing component in one of your customer relationship, that would be a finance type of item. So.
I think the FRC document is also supporting having one single classification.
Yes, correct.
Irrespective of
option
the fact
must
that
be removed. Everything has a one specific defined activity, one of these three. So, but it doesn't matter whether that's an interest expense or not. Any kind of interest expense might not be classified as a financing activity, you know, in the old cases, maybe.
You are saying all cases, yes.
Yeah, you are suggesting in all cases just one classification of interest in paid expense received. But if the FRC has a, but based on this, your analysis of paragraph 16 and 16B, so the UK FRC, after this feedback, they suggest one financing activity classification. That's right.
Before their feedback, so at the moment, at the time that they issued their discussion paper, they were proposing one single classification. Now, if you compare the answers that they got or the suggestions that they had in the discussion paper in 16, they do not necessarily match our suggestions in the paper. Most of them, we have the same answer, but not for all of them. But I mean, we are in the same line of thought. The removal of options, that's there.
I mean, that's okay. Yeah.
Can we try to move this on a little bit? Martin?
Only question, does this proposal also mean for conglomerates that they have to decide? So if a car company in Germany which has leasing and banking also included, so have to decide either if it is operating or financing, or can they, because what I'm reading on paragraph 21, you have to decide.
Yeah,
and I think if we have to decide for this kind of companies, it is not adequate, and therefore I'm against.
A lot of the questions that we've been asking on the project, we've been asking people to focus just on a simple company rather than looking at conglomerates or finance companies. A lot of the stuff that we have talked about in terms of EBIT, it raises problems for things like conglomerates and finance companies, and we're going to bring those back.
Also for this, you bring that back later.
Yeah.
Okay, then I'm fine.
Mary?
I'm supportive of removing the options. I think maybe this paper, especially in contrast with the previous one, maybe stand back and think about whether we can provide a better articulation of an anchor for the decisions we make about, you know, which option we eliminate. And I don't know if we can stand back and say we are going to approach IAS 7 as it is written now, because this is not an IAS 7 project, as either kind of by function or by nature. And you know, that came home to me, particularly in terms of the capitalized interest on, let's say, a self-constructed asset. Do you regard that as nature? Its nature is, finance, a finance expense, or function? It's being incurred to finance, you know, a new operating asset. And if we thought that there was a possibility of articulating it as A or B, you know, that we're reading it through that lens, it would take a list of decisions and hopefully tie them together. I don't know that it would make us change any, but it wouldn't automatically answer every question, because I think you still have to think about some things individually, but it might help us do more than answer the specific questions that are here. The caveat I attach to that is, if you decide to look at it, and as soon as you look at it, you say this is going to, you know, mushroom into a big statement of cash flow project, fold it back up and put it in a box and put it away, because our main target is the statement of performance, and this is secondary, and it would be nice to do the secondary stuff if it's low-hanging fruit.
I think we have done a certain amount of thinking about that, and I think the answer was that would inevitably mushroom into bigger things and making bigger changes to the statement of cash flows. And really what we were doing is just focusing on eliminating options and picking the approach that seemed to be the most sensible in most cases.
Yeah. I guess the halfway house is, in making this package of decisions, are we going to make it generally from one perspective of the other, not trying to reinterpret all of I7 in the context.
I just would like to add that I don't think I7 refers at all to by function or by nature, and I think, in my view, operating, financing, investing activities are defined really as a hybrid. You can interpret them either as by function or by nature definition, and since I7 does not use that distinction, well, my question would be, do we really want to make that distinction now? And we think we should rather leave it just for the statement of performance and just leave the statement of cash flows alone in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Denise started with that there were compelling arguments, and really in the eyes of the reader, but I found them compelling. So just a couple of things that have already been made. One is, yeah, so you've got interest, essentially, we're thinking kind of bonds and banks, and to come are details about payables and stuff. Like, so you're going to have to define interest really carefully to get this to work. Second one is analogy to the insurance standard. We ended up focusing on insurance contracts, not the insurance industry. I think we've done that in other places. This is probably a good thing to do here with the conglomerates. So, you know, entities that have lending things, do you want to approach it that way, or do you want to do it for an industry, is a critical thing to decide. And then the other thing I said, which I did find it compelling, is I agree, I think, with this and all the others, but I would put the emphasis somewhere else. I think removing the option is good. The more important thing is that I think across most of these, and I may give detail later, you put it in the right place. Okay, and I'd actually swing around if I was selling this and say, we are putting all these items in the right places and removing options at the same time. Mm. Because I think that's the more important thing. You know, are we producing a more useful statement of cash flow? When I kind of try and apply a litmus test the way people would use the information, I think yes, when I went through them. So I think to some degree you're underselling by simply being a removal of options.
I understand.
Okay, can we have a vote? Who agrees with the staff recommendation?
It's 13 in favor.
All right.
Okay. So moving on to issue 2A, analyzed in paragraphs 25 to 27. As part of this issue, we explained that the rationale in I7 for classifying interest paid and interest and dividends received as operating activities, just because they enter into the determination of profit or loss, is not sound, because we think that it really ignores the the operating nature of the cash flow as defined in paragraph 6 of IS 7. Consequently, our recommendation below paragraph 27 is to ignore this rationale and focus on, instead on the, well, the definition of operating paragraph 6 of IS 7 and in determining whether these cash flows are operating in nature or are operating. I'm going to avoid the nature word. So does the board agree with this recommendation?
Okay.
14 in favor.
Okay. So let's move on to issues 2B and 2E, which focus on eliminating the choice in the classification of interest paid, interest that is capitalized and dividends paid, and interest and dividends received. So starting with issue 2B, this issue is concerned with the classification of interest paid and is analyzed in paragraphs 28 to 34. We recommend that interest paid is classified as a financing activity for the reasons given in paragraph 32. So our analysis is based on the definition of financing in paragraph 6 of IS 7, as well as on the proposed clarification that we made to this definition at the November 2017 meeting, if you remember. So our question below paragraph 34 is whether the board agrees with this recommendation that interest paid should be classified as a financing activity.
Nick?
Just one quick issue on that. Just going back to paragraph 17 and the FRC feedback statement. There was the feedback just making sure that interest payments paid continues to be separated from the repayments of the principal. Would that still be the case under these proposals?
Well, I don't see. Yeah, well, I think it would still be a requirement.
Yeah, okay, as long as that's the case, I'm happy to support it. Maybe it gets wrapped up, it gets to be very dangerous.
What are you doing with the zero coupon bond?
Well, if there is no interest paid, there's no. It's just repayment principle. Effective,
flow.
Yeah.
There's no cash flow.
Well, when you at maturity,
true in those periodic periods, it's a different nature of, I guess, economically it's the same, but it's
so please don't complicate it again.
It'd be nice if it worked.
No, it's worth thinking carefully about, but I think the principle we got.
Can we support the staff's recommendation?
13 in favor.
So moving on to issue 2C, this issue focuses on the classification of interest paid that is capitalized into the cost of an asset and is analyzed in paragraphs 35 to 40. So as part of this analysis, we highlight the fact that interest paid that is capitalized could potentially be considered an investing cash flow in accordance with paragraph 16 of IS 7. However, the guidance in paragraphs 32 to 33 of IS 7 appear to require interest paid to be classified only as an operating or a financing cash flow. So we consider as part of our analysis that the IFRS Interpretations Committee identified this issue as the subject of a potential improvement to IS 7, and the Interpretations Committee recommended that the classification should follow the nature of the underlying, of the related cash flows of the underlying asset. Both concerns were raised regarding the implementation of this identification of the cash flows about the implementation of such a proposal. So we therefore recommend in paragraph 40 that interest paid, whether capitalized or not, should always be financing, just for simplicity purposes. And we ask below paragraph 40 whether the board agrees with this recommendation.
Oh, sorry, may I ask a question? Sorry, very sorry. So I'm sorry, dear. Capitalized, as a maybe that's similar to the Mary's question before, maybe this is a kind of a, if the cost of the asset that includes some kind of interest expense, then we have separated that part into a financing activity.
Yeah. That would be the consequence.
Yeah, that would be.
Yes. That would be the consequence.
So I think this is right, but if we think, you know, maybe we can see this is a two-stage. At the first stage, all interest expense as a kind of finance activity. But next stage, this interest expense can be used as a kind of a operating asset investment.
In that case, then at the second stage, this interest expense can be no.
No.
We are just to
stick always to financing.
Always financing.
So, all right. Not happy.
Just the one observation, because here, I think this question is the most relevant to the IAS 23 borrowing costs.
Yes.
And if we look at the definition of borrowing costs are the interest and other costs that an entity incurs in connection with the borrowing of funds. So what's other part, other costs? Because there are other borrowing costs capitalized as the maybe the components of PP somewhere.
Yeah,
so whether it's included here as a financing cash flow or others, so this is just like with regard to the, what's the meaning of the interest and the, what's the difference between the interest and the borrowing costs.
No, I think what you're saying is that any associated cost with that.
Because we never defined what's the interest and, you know, so borrowing costs we defined in the standards. So, but in practice, maybe sometimes other borrowing costs is very high beyond the interest. So we consider this kind of financing cost.
I think
whether
you're
this
right.
Kind of financing will go to which place, yeah.
It's just in this paper, we're just focusing on the interest paid part of that borrowing cost. But I think in practice, the associated costs to that, that borrowing should also be financing.
Well, I don't think we've actually
But we haven't analyzed that. Okay. Yes.
It's very important because.
Yeah.
Tom,
just small again. I'll echo my other comment without going into detail. I think this is also the right place to put it, and I think the combination of what you would get on the statement of financial performance and the cash flow is a better information package if we exhausted the detail. So I think, at least for me, this is more than simplicity. I think it's a genuine improvement.
Okay. Can we support staff's recommendation?
Okay. 13.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on to issue 2D. This issue concerns the classification of dividends paid. It's analyzed in paragraphs 41 to 45. We recommend that dividends paid are classified as a financing activity for the reasons given in paragraph 42. So we ask below paragraph 45 whether the board agrees with this recommendation.
That should be a slam dunk.
Yeah. 13. Okay, let's move on to the controversial issue. So issue 2E, this issue focuses on the classification of interest received and dividends received and is analyzed in paragraphs 46 to 59. Determining a single classification for these items is difficult. Is problematic, as we explained in paragraph 47. This is because the rationale used in paragraph 33 of IS 7 for classifying interest and dividends received as investing activities, i.e. that interest and dividends receive a returns on investment, appears to contradict the definition of investing activities given in paragraph 6 of IS 7, because this definition refers to returns of investments. Mm. So the definition in paragraph 6 of IS 7, we take this classify these items would lead to classify interest and dividends received as operating, so they are not investing, they are part of operating cash flows. So as we mentioned in paragraph 49, we think that these cash flows should be investing cash flows, but identifying them would necessarily imply an amendment to the definition of investing activities in paragraph 6 of IS 7. So we have identified two ways in which we could make this amendment, of course, if you agree that an amendment is necessary. So we've got two approaches in the paper, approach A and approach B. Basically, approach A is just to make a slight amendment to the definition of investing activities to include interest and dividends received, whereas approach B would make a more significant change to the definition of investing, and we would potentially replace it with the definition of investing that we developed for the statement of performance, which is a broad definition, it's a broader definition of everything that is investing. So as we explain in paragraphs 55 to 56, we recommend that the board classify interest received and dividends received as investing cash flows. We also recommend the board to amend the definition of investing activities in paragraph 6 of I7 using approach A, using the simple approach, the more simple approach, for the reasons provided in paragraph 56. Now, our recommendation, as we said in the paper, does not include the classification of dividends received from associates and joint ventures, because the board might decide to have a further discussion about the location of the share of associates and joint ventures in the statement of financial performance, and this classification might affect the classification in the statement of cash flows. So we ask below paragraph 46 whether the board agrees with this recommendation that interest received, what I just mentioned.
Mary? I agree with the staff recommendation to take something based on approach day, and agree with the proposed classification. I did have a question I wanted you to think about after the meeting rather than on your feet, which is in paragraph 58, you say, and the receipt of interest and dividends. And I was left wondering why we didn't say more generally the return on them. So just if I could ask you to think about that outside the context of the meeting. I just didn't want us to be wedded to this language by virtue of those.
Okay.
Well, I must admit that I have an inclination to approach B, because it's one thing to not make an absolute search for consistency between statements. It's also, in a way, a pity to leave some opportunities aside when they present themselves. Now, there are two things which have which lead me to supporting your recommendation of approach A. The first one is the feedback that the FRC has received on their proposals, and which is really not supportive of going into the direction that would be the results of approach B. And the second is the arguments that you bring of keeping it simple, but not to amend the standard into too widely. Now, this, in my view, will hopefully bring us in a position to bring changes and improvements to the market in a quicker manner.
Ben Chow.
Thank you. First, I supported approach A, but one thing. I think even we adopted approach A, I think we try our best to align the cash flow statement and the performance statement, because we have made a decision that the interest received from cash and cash equivalents will be classified as financial activities. Mm-hmm. So this is clear. So I think that the definition here we give, Mary said that investing activities are the acquisition and disposal of long-term assets and other investments not included in cash equivalents. I would like to suggest that not included in cash and cash equivalents, and the receive or maybe return of the interest and dividends arising or from those investments. So then it will be excluded those interest and dividends, and those items will be aligned with the performance statement.
The problem is the definition in IS7 refers to long-term investments, and actually we are, but in the definition that we've got in the EBIT papers, we're just talking about investments for stocks. It could be short-term.
Yeah, but here I think we mentioned long-term assets and other investments. So I think it can include, both, yeah.
Yeah, well, these other investments here, in reality, is referring to short-term investments. Okay. Because there is another paragraph in I-7 I have it here somewhere, but there is another paragraph in I-7 which excludes cash flows from trading activities, so you interpret that those are from short-term investments. Yeah. So, well, it's what Rachel is saying. The emphasis here is on long-term investment. So we will never have a perfect alignment between the statement of performance and the statement of cash flows under the current staff proposals for the statement of financial performance. Because we've got you know, we've got some short investments below investing.
Yeah.
Some others could be part of investing. The long-term investments, we've got them. They are not operating. They're they're operating the same amount of cash flows for the same financial performance they're investing. But in short, if we wanted to align it, we will have to rewrite.
Yeah.
The definition of investing in the statement of cash flows.
I think it's possible we can align with performance statement and cash flow. Just make some wording change somewhere. Yeah.
Tak.
Yes, just almost same point as Jin Chao pointed out. So, for example, if you borrow money from the bank, but instead you have to make a deposit, and then you have to receive some interest.
Yeah,
which is really offsetting the interest payment. Even in that case, you say those interest received should be recognized as a
investment.
That is what you are requiring. So because approach, I'm talking about approach A. So if you go to approach A, it's just a rule base. So no matter what the interest is for, it is classified as investment.
Well, yeah, you see approach as a rules-based, but it's just that, you know, the existing definition is also very rules-based, and even the examples that are there.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that we are saying is we don't want now a significant change to the definition of investing.
Okay. Gary, and then let's vote.
In IFRS 15, like, you have rep receivables of long-term financing components, and there's other interest received or financing received from customers, where would that fit in here? Is this operating or financing? That interest income or financing income?
You said on trading?
In IFRS 15, you've got long-term receivables, significant financing component. And for example, that would apply. There's interest income on that. And there's other long-term customer receivables.
I think those would be operating.
Okay, that's a good answer, Scott.
Can we support approach A as proposed by the staff?
We have 12 in favor.
All right.
Quickly. Yes, Tom and I had a discussion during the break, and the studies that we're referring to by the CFA Institute, a survey, it's an international survey. It's not, I said it was US and UK, but that's a different one. So the one we're discussing was international.
Okay. I'm glad that this
you're both right.
Matter has been resolved.
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
Promise.
Denise?
Yes. Thank you. So let's move on to agenda paper 21B. This paper provides some initial thoughts on two other potential improvements to the statement of cash flows. So in section one, we analyze the first improvement that we analyze in section one of this paper is specifying a consistent starting point for the indirect reconciliation of cash flows. So our research and outreach activities have revealed that there is diversity in practice, so entities use different starting points. So in paragraph 9, we set out two options. The board could either make clear that profit or loss is the starting point and make it really clear, even though it's already kind of clear in I7, or the board could require another subtotal as the starting point because, well, as part of our developments in the statement of financial performance, we have developed some other subtotals that may be interesting to consider. So in paragraph 14, we recommend that the board consider having a consistent starting point and perhaps consider requiring as the starting point one of the subtotals proposed for the statement of financial performance. We are suggesting that this could be the profit before investing, financing, and income tax, because as we attempt to demonstrate in Appendix A, this would simplify the indirect reconciliation of cash flows. So we ask below paragraph 18 whether the board agrees with this recommendation.
You said, Denise?
Yes.
Second question. Could be the starting point. It could be a profit before. I'm sorry. Could be a profit. I mean, do you mean that literally, or is that just an example of your thinking?
Well, I think what we're saying is that would be our recommendation to require that one in particular.
But if I take it through, if it is included, what if it's not included?
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, what would be so wrong with net income or income from continuing operations? Something like that. It's an after-tax number.
Yeah, well,
I think we're probably more covering situations where perhaps somebody doesn't have an investing category and so doesn't present that and jump straight yeah. to the EBIT subtotal. I think that's what we're trying to cover. I think what we're saying is that what we're generally saying is that the higher up you go in the income statement, the simpler your reconciliation is. And so what we're suggesting is it's the highest subtotal that we're requiring in the financial statements, which would typically be profit before investing, financing, and income tax.
Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure why it's simpler. I mean, ultimately, a lot of items below EBIT affect cash flow too, or affect net change in cash.
I think the point is that you end up with fewer reconciling items.
Yeah, in the operating section.
Oh, okay. By the way, I fully agree there should be one consistent starting point. I'm just not so sure this is it. But it was a group.
Mary?
I agree with the staff recommendation to have a consistent starting point. I had some concern that we're doing standard setting to address a compliance issue rather than a problem in the standard. Having said that, I think we contributed to the compliance issue by including in the ISB's examples and illustration that was inconsistent with the requirement. So that probably blows through any of my high-mindedness about that one. So I think we should do it. We should specify one, and especially if we end up consulting with an ED rather than a discussion paper. Then I think we haven't made that decision yet about what the next stage is. I think we should identify alternatives if we, in case we don't go ahead with that, earnings before profit before investing, financing, and income tax, so that we don't end up caught in bind. If we end up as a result of whatever that document is, abandoning the anchor that we proposed.
Nick?
Users would very much welcome a consistent starting point. I mean, clearly in the US we've had a consistent starting point, I think, for years, net income. I do echo what Rachel says, actually, having a starting point higher up the statement of financial performance is better in terms of having fewer reconciling items. So if you start with net income, you have to first of all adjust for interest accrued, and then you've got to deduct, you'd add back your interest accrued and then take off your interest paid. So you have to kind of make two entries. If you start with something closer to operating, you would just take off your interest paid. So it's a simpler, probably more intuitive representation of the cash flow statement. So I fully support staff recommendation in that respect.
I think I do. I think for the reasons Nick mentioned, I would at some point like to see a bit of stress testing with all the ins and outs, because I haven't actually done that, just to make sure that there's not some interesting account that doesn't fit into this very well when we get there, whether you do it through consulting people or not. But I really would like to see some examples across a series of firms. But in principle, I think a common starting point's excellent. This one makes a lot of sense intuitively to me.
Martin?
An only question. We also deal with financial institutions and others then later?
Just to say I agree in the same terms as Mary has expressed.
Okay, can we support the staff's recommendation?
13 in favor.
So moving on to section two of the paper, the second targeted improvement we address in this section is the potential alignment of the operating section across the statement of cash flows and the statement of financial performance. As we explain in paragraph 17, we do not think the board should pursue this alignment because the board has had difficulties in trying to define operating profit. Moreover, well, as we explained in the paper, we think that this alignment will not be entirely possible. So our recommendation for the board is that it should focus on making targeted improvements to the statement of cash flows only, recognizing that these statements have got a separate and distinct purpose. So we also think that the staff could continue to investigate other potential improvements, such as those outlined in paragraph 19, and present their findings at the future meeting. So we ask the board whether it agrees with this conclusion below paragraph 20, whether the board agrees with our recommendations.
Well, you're telling us a full alignment is not possible.
Yes, yes.
So you're asking us to not do the impossible.
Well, what I'm...
Not attempt to do it.
It's just at the very outset of this project, we made a promise that we would completely, fully align the operating section across the statements. And, you know, after all discussions we had over 2 years, we haven't reached a conclusion of what is really operating or not. So we think that this target improvement is not feasible at the moment, at least.
Agree?
Agreed.
So that's it?
Was that also covering that final question about exploring two additional?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, well, we can ask that separate question about whether you think we should explore additional targeted improvements, such as the ones that we referred to in paragraph 19, A and B. Do you think we should bring back, we should bring those?
Who does not agree?
I don't agree either. I think there's nothing here to do. I think lots of people wanted to put CapEx in the operating section. When I think of investment, particularly reinvestments, as choices in terms of how you deploy your cash flow between CapEx, investment associates, M&A, so I think it fits more naturally in the investing section. So I don't see widespread call to pursue these issues particularly.
Tom?
Agree with Nick completely on the CapEx. The tax one, I'm to be honest, I don't know for certain. I wouldn't mind, it may be worthwhile just exploring that one a little bit. I have some ideas why that I won't kind of go into right now, but that one to me is a little bit different. It might be worth exploring.
What sort of cash taxes paid, cash taxes received, usually in multi-jurisdiction, or just be its own line item?
Yeah. But.
And taxes.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I'm not quite. Right now, it's in operating. Yeah. And, you know, in some of the stuff I've read, some of the analysts' stuff, when I've read, you know, things they'd like to see and so on, have argued to take tax out. I think there's some other evidence, to isolate it. So at this point, I don't know if this would be a good thing. I wouldn't mind checking a couple of things down. One of the questions I sometimes ask myself is, why did EBITDA become the favorite and not cash from operations? Because most analysts will say EBITDA is a measure of cash. Well, cash from operations is a better measure of cash. Yeah. What does EBITDA get you? It takes out the interest and it takes out
tax.
And buried in that choice, which is pretty widespread, I think there's some reasons why the tax is important.
And by the way, I thought for years taxes should be its own section of the cash flow statement. In fact, I think the FRC, you know, when Andrew was here a few years back, that was one of their recommendations. And, you know, some stuff netted tax, some plus that gums it up. I think every number should be a pre-tax number as much as you can and put tax all in its own place. So, nonetheless, you're only asking, should we explore? So the answer is yes.
Yeah, I absolutely explore, because I don't know if I'd want to go there at the end. I just get enough signals that there might be some value.
Mary?
No conclusions about these two items, but unless we have screaming evidence that they're really important to solve, I think I go back to the first part of your question. Do we support the staff view that you would be making targeted improvements? Yes, and I think those targeted improvements should be the elimination of the options. Okay. And as soon as we start to add things on, even if it's only explore, I think we're just not maintaining our discipline.
Can I see who does not agree with the staff recommendation?
What's the, sorry, what's the question?
Which is the second
question? Okay.
Should not work.
So the second question?
Yes.
Okay.
Not do it.
Sorry, can we do it one more time? Not to do it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
I wanted the last vote to be positive, so.
Okay, thank you very much. We made progress.